Weekday evenings on FM 101.5 and AM 1400, The Patriot. It's 6 o'clock talk with Daryl Wood. Host Daryl Wood brings you the day's news and trending topics as only he can, with a unique blend of conservative opinion, constitutionalism, and thought-provoking analysis. Join the conversation. 6 o'clock talk with Daryl Wood. A daily look at the news in a way you won't hear anywhere else. Tune in to 6 o'clock talk with Daryl Wood on FM 101.5 and AM 1400, The Patriot, or stream at patriotdetroit.com.
You are in what part of the country?
Southwest Colorado.
Wonderful. How are you picking us up?
Oh, I stream you guys on my iPhone every day.
Fantastic.
I am a resident of Sterling Heights, but I frequently come to Southwest Colorado.
I am just thrilled to be hearing from you out there in Colorado. Continue to listen, tune in again, and call at your earliest convenience. Godspeed.
Run to Win with Daryl Wood, Monday through Friday at 4 p.m. on Faith Talk Detroit.
Welcome to the Jewish Hour. I'm your host, Herschel Finman. We've got a great show for you today. In this half hour of the show, we have Shlomo Brody. This is a rebroadcast. Shlomo Brody, Ethics of Our Fighters, wrote a book. We played this way back at the beginning of the year. It was a great book, great read, and still, unfortunately, very appropriate to what's going on in the world. In the second half hour of the show, we will be featuring some insights into the portion of Kedoshim, which can be found in Leviticus chapter 19. We'll have a cappella music. We're in those weeks between Passover and Shavuos. That was a little bit of klezmer a cappella. There's not too much klezmer a cappella out there in the world. And that was sort of like pseudo-klezmer a cappella, as you caught from the last couple of bars over there. But we have some real Jewish a cappella music for you, like we have every year. Wow. We'll be rounding out with a really insightful Hasidic story soon, all the way to the end. Let's go right now to Shlomo Brody and our interview with Ethics of Our Fighters. Okay, why did you feel it necessary? I guess it's to every author. Why do you feel it necessary to write this book that you wrote, Ethics of Our Fighters?
Yeah, no, the pun, of course, is gets people. I sometimes mispronounce my own book as well. But I think that, you know, Jewish tradition has a lot of teachings about the ethics of proper behavior. And that's, of course, where the tractate in the Talmud comes from, of ethics of our fathers. But we haven't had a lot to say about the ethics of how to fight war, and that's because we didn't have power for many, many centuries. And since, really, the 20th century, the issues have come up. They've become quite acute about military ethics. And I wanted to try to put together a comprehensive statement about what Judaism might say about this topic, which, unfortunately, is all too relevant given what's going on in Israel.
Okay, so it's I'm not going to say it's easier, but it's sort of like the mechanism is in place that if there's a new invention that wasn't discussed in biblical times or Talmudic times, like a refrigerator or an electric range or something like that, there were general principles that were laid down by Moses to the Jewish people when they're in the desert as to how to approach a certain specific detail, which they didn't know about yet. And then they just need to plug in these details into the general principles. Is this the same thing with as far as approaching halacha, Jewish law and war, Shlomo Brody?
It's not quite the same. I mean, I'll tell you, like in my regular work for Amatai, which deals with end-of-life care dilemmas. So it's true modern medicine and modern technology gives us a lot of different new tools on how to treat people. But for centuries, we were dealing with end-of-life questions, and we laid down principles over the centuries. When it comes to the issue of military ethics, you do, of course, have some passages in the Torah from Moses, and you do have some passages in the Talmud. But after that, it's pretty skim. And so what I try to show, however, is in spite of that fact, if you look hard and look well, you can derive a lot of underlying principles or values, which I do think the Jewish tradition provides. And it actually, I argue, gives us a great framework for thinking about some of these new dilemmas that we have today. So it's not quite the same as other issues like a refrigerator or whatnot, because we have a little bit of less precedent, but I still think there's actually a lot to work with here, and it's very inspiring.
Okay, so let's talk about this a little bit. So the two wars which are discussed in the five books of Moses, for the most part, or the wars that which are discussed in the five books of Moses, are, say, like the war against the Moloch, the war against Midian, the conquest of Sihon and Og. In all of those instances, it was basically what would be described in modern times as war atrocities. They were wiping out in the war of Midian. They killed everybody. And the Moloch was supposed to wipe out the last single person, no more Amalekite. An understanding that back then, the way things ran were, I mean, we're talking about war was, I'm going to chop your head off before you chop my head off. That if I didn't kill everybody, they're going to come back and kill me. So can we apply such theory to 21st century, Shlomo Brody?
I don't think so. I don't think that we'd apply the same type of ethos that existed then, and we'd apply that today. Then there's really what we call a total war strategy, which means you use all resources and there are very little restraints about how you fight war. I think in many ways, as Rabbi Abraham Isaac Cook taught us, and others as well, warfare has changed for the better in certain respects, and our ethics have changed. And so, I think that we can understand still, and even we see this in biblical passages also, and other rabbinic principles as well, that there is an importance to having some form of restraint on warfare. I do think, however, that the Bible teaches us something very important, and particularly with regard to vicious enemies or vicious countries like Amalek, which is that evil needs to be destroyed from the world. And unfortunately, I think the West, to certain respects, has lost sight of this fact that sometimes the types of enemies that we're fighting are so grave and they're so terrific people. The way we understood during World War II, how we understood how the Nazis had to be defeated, that there had to be absolute victory. And I think that in that respect, the Bible is very, very important for our teaching to us today. But that doesn't mean we have to fight the same way as biblical warriors fought. And I think rabbis over the past century have asserted that repeatedly.
Okay, very good for making that clarification. Okay, so let's jump. Half the book is history. I love history, and it's presented very well. I was riveted by the first half of the book, just the historical perspective of the way you presented it. So let's jump up to modern times. Last week, we had the consul general from Israel on the show, and the title of the show was Fighting the Propaganda War in Gaza. It seems as though that when it comes to warfare, Jews are expected to be the underdog. We're expected to be the minority. There's a joke. I can stretch this joke out for 20 minutes, but just the punchline of the joke is there's a hijacking. And the hijackers find that one of the passengers is an Israeli, and they say, we're going to throw you off the plane, but you have one request. And he says, my one request is that I'm going to turn around, and I'm going to bend over, and I want you to kick me in the behind. So he said, okay. So they kick him in the behind. He rolls, as he's falling down, he pulls a gun out of his sock and shoots the hijackers. So they said, that's very interesting that you did that, but why did you make them kick you in the behind? He said, I didn't want to appear like the aggressor. So this is sort of like the mindset that people have that we're not supposed to win wars. We're not supposed to be the aggressor. We're not supposed to be, somebody attacks us. Okay, we defend ourselves. But to do what's happening now, and how many times the Palestinian propaganda is that there's a genocide going on. Could you address this point, please, Shlomo Brody?
Yeah, no, I think it's an important one. There's no doubt that we have a lot of obstacles when it comes to public relations, some of which, we could do a little bit better about by explaining what we're doing. But a lot of this just has to do with plain old anti-Semitism or some form of bias against Israel. And I think it's important for us to understand that we need to build up our own moral fortitude and our own moral understanding of what we are doing and why we're doing it. And then recognize the fact that sometimes this means we're going to have to go on the offensive. out of self-defense. I mean, this is probably one of the biggest lessons we're going to have to learn from October 7th, which is that we knew that Hamas was a big threat for many, many years. And we sort of, what we called in Israel, mowed the grass every now and then. We would go in there and cut back a little bit on some of the fighters. But we didn't try to systematically address the issue that and the threat that Hamas was presenting. And I think part of that was because we felt that the international community was going to condemn us for that. And I think part of the moral lesson, let alone strategic lesson that we can learn from here, is that at times the Jewish people, the state of Israel, need to understand that we need to be proactive about our defense. Self-defense is a moral imperative. It's not just a strategic matter. And we have to recognize the fact that when we have a threat and it's bubbling against us, even if it's not imminent, but it's credible and grave, we have to address it. And I think we're going to be thinking long and hard about questions like how to deal with Hezbollah in northern Israel on the Lebanese border, and of course as well with Iran. Are we going to wait for Iran to have a nuclear bomb? I mean, we have to really think about these issues. And so I think we have to take a little stock of what happened here and recognize the fact that the world is going to judge us how they're going to judge us, but we need to do what it takes in order to protect our people.
Okay. Our guest today, again, is Shlomo Brody. He's written a book called Ethics of Our Fighters, A Jewish View on War and Morality, which I think the terms war and morality might be mutually exclusive one with the other. So the propaganda is being perpetrated is that there's too many little kids getting killed. Their hospitals are being destroyed. People, the refugees have no place to go. There's no humanitarian aid being allowed in as the Jews, as Israelis are trying to clear out Hamas in Gaza. So where do we draw, where's our moral compass? Where's our moral line that we're saying, well, we can do this, but any further than that is crossing the line. And no, we're not going to act like the rest of the world, which may have carpet bombed the entire Gaza at this point. Rabbi Brody.
Yeah, no, I think war and morality are not contradictions. And part of what we have to figure out is how to understand what it is to morally fight a war. When it comes to issues of collateral damage and the unfortunate deaths of non-combatants, so we always have to ask ourselves, are we just going to war in the first place? And I think here it's readily obvious that Israel had to defend itself. And the next question is the means that are allowed in these cases. Israel is targeting combatants alone. It's very, very important. I try to argue this from a religious level as well, that it's important to only target combatants. However, as with all wars, non-combatants are going to be caught up in the crossfire sometimes. Sometimes because that's people that are very sympathetic, in this case with Hamas, sometimes not. But either way, we shouldn't be targeting them. But unfortunately, they're going to be harmed as well. But we have to look carefully and ask, why are they being harmed? In the theories of just war, it's always stressed that both sides have to try to minimize civilian casualties. In this case, Hamas is using human shields, not just fighting within the people, but underneath the people. It's really unprecedented in many ways. And we have to keep on reiterating the reason why so many Gazan civilians are being harmed is because Hamas is fighting in their midst. It's because Egypt won't open the border and accept refugees. It's because Hamas isn't doing what it's supposed to do by international law to prevent harm to its citizens. And so we have to keep on reiterating this. And unfortunately, it might take many more casualties until we can root out the Hamas fighters. But that's on a moral level, on Hamas's responsibility. So I think we just need to keep on stressing this point and stressing this to ourselves, while, of course, always keeping in mind all human beings were created in the image of God. We certainly are regretful of the fact that people who aren't directly attacking us are dying in this war. But nonetheless, we have a moral responsibility to protect our people.
Okay, so Hamas is doing something wrong, but then we could argue and say, well, does that give the right to the IDF, the Israelis, in the name of self-defense, to also do something wrong, Shlomo Brody?
We have the right to do something in self-defense, and it's not wrong. It is not wrong for us to fight and try to kill Hamas and their leaders and their terrorists and bring back our captives. That's a moral imperative. the fact that some of the Earth's civilians are also being harmed or killed in the process is not our moral responsibility. We should do what we can to try to minimize those casualties. And Israel's taking great steps to forewarn, to try to clear people out of the area. But when push comes to shove, we have a trumping moral responsibility to bring back our captives, which somehow the world seems to forget, and also to eliminate this threat from our borders. We cannot go on living this way with having someone on this border who has pledged to try to wipe out the entire state of Israel.
Okay, understood. Now, in previous attempts, and I kind of say it like tongue-in-cheek and roll my eyes at this point, that since 2014, every 2 years, I have somebody on from the Israeli consul, and I say to them, okay, so you're being attacked in from Gaza, and you're going to go in there, and you're going to do something, and then you don't do anything, you don't do enough, and then we come back in 2 years, and what's going to be in 2 years from now? But in all those times, and I didn't hear it this time. Maybe you did. Maybe I just wasn't listening because I've been telling people at this point that they should just turn off the news. It's like too much to process. The disproportional response. They're a people that are the Hamas is fighting with homemade rockets that are made out of sewer pipes, and Israel is coming in with targeted missiles and electronic equipment and computerized this and laser technology that. So, what about the disproportionate response? Is that moral? Is that ethical?
Well, I don't think we're being disproportionate. We're not being disproportionate. We have to understand. When proportionality is used in the context of military ethics, it means the following. When you are attacking a military target and you know there's going to be collateral damage, you have to assess, is the gained military benefit proportionate to the potential damage that will happen to others? And each time Israel strikes, they have to take into that, that equation into consideration, which is why there are times when Israel will cancel, abort, a shot or an army missile or a drone missile attack because of the fact that there are too many civilians or children, whoever might be around. But on many occasions, it is proportionate in terms of given the military goal here. So the fact that, this precisely, you raised a good point. We've tried to do low-level wars, 10-day interventions, 3-week battles, maybe 2 months, whatever it might be. And that hasn't failed. It hasn't served as a deterrent to Hamas, hasn't dealt with the issue. So at this stage, Israel's sort of left without no choice, and it has to do something more systematic to root out the threat from its border. That's a proportionate response. There's nothing disproportionate about the way Israel's behaving.
Okay, so in your mind, in your perspective, would you say that Israel's totally and completely righteous without fault?
No, there are times when, of course, we make mistakes. There are times when maybe we could look back. Of course, it's easy to be Monday morning quarterback and say maybe this wasn't necessary. This wasn't right. Sure, that can happen. And when that happens, we need to do a certain amount of evaluation. Sometimes soldiers err, and they need to be addressed as well if they make those mistakes. But I think overall, the overall picture here, Israel has a just cause to go to war and is fighting in a way in which we are trying to eliminate the threat while minimizing civilian casualties. If you look at the numbers and you say, let's say Hamas is right, the Gaza Medical Services who report to Hamas and say 25,000 have been killed so far. And let's say Israel's right and they say 9,000 Hamas fighters have been killed. If you look at that proportion, you look at the ratio we're talking about here, it's about 1.8. non-combatants to one combatant, that is incredibly low compared to what goes on when America was in Afghanistan, when the British were in Afghanistan or in Iraq, and many other wars as well. So we have to recognize the fact that war is unfortunate, war is tragic, but that doesn't mean war isn't moral. And that's what I want to stress in this book and what I really feel is important for people to understand. War and morality do go together. The fact that they're suffering doesn't mean that someone behaved in a moral way. And in this case, it means that Israel isn't behaving in a moral way as well. I think Israel is doing a very, very good job of trying to fight a difficult war in a moral manner.
Okay, isn't it, again, our guest today is Shlomo Brody, written a book called Ethics of Our Fighters, A Jewish View on War and Morality. Jews are supposed to be better, though. Even the nations of the world, all the goyim, no. Jews are supposed to be better. I mean, you had in 1981, you had a bunch of Christians that went and massacred a Lebanese Palestinian refugee camp, and the Jews got blamed because Jews are supposed to be better. Aren't, in this instance, aren't Jews also supposed to be better? Not just think, okay, so in Afghanistan, it was like 2.1 ratio, and in Gaza, it's 1.8, and so we're a little bit better, but Jews are supposed to be like totally better. Even in the eyes of the world, Shlomo Brody.
I do think that we have a moral imperative to behave properly, and we should care. But, you know, in the case that we're dealing with here, we're dealing with a situation where I think we're doing as best as we can. And the moral imperative that we have is to behave properly. The fact that the world sometimes criticizes us is irrelevant to that point. And so I think we should not be obsessed with what everyone thinks about us. We should be obsessed about making sure that we live up to our own standards.
Okay. I noticed also somebody pointed out to me that in some of the quote-unquote indiscriminate bombing that the IDF was doing, that there was a 700-year-old mosque which was destroyed, and I believe in Gaza City. So 700 years is a long time for a building to be standing, to just sort of look at, get blown up. And I'm wondering your take on that, Shlomo.
Well, I don't know the specific cases, but if that mosque was being used for military purposes, if there were fighters that were hiding in there, if there were people that were hiding weapons there and shooting from there, then Hamas has then turned their mosque into a legitimate military target. They shouldn't be doing that. The whole purpose of the laws of war is to protect certain areas, like hospitals. But we know Hamas uses hospitals to hide there as well, to hide their weapons, hide their fighters, hide captives also. And if that's what they're using for the mosque, then Hamas bears responsibility for turning that mosque into a legitimate target. I mean, it would be absurd to think that if someone is shooting from a mosque and is threatening your soldiers or your people, you can't shoot at it because it's been there for 700 years. And part of the tragedy of this situation is what Hamas has done to the Palestinian society and to the Palestinian people. But that's their responsibility. That's their moral guilt, not ours.
Okay, understood. Okay, so now you've written this book, Ethics of Our Fighters, and you hope that it becomes a New York Times bestseller. What do you want the takeaway from this book to be? Somebody reads the book, somebody who has no clue about the subject, they pick up the title because it's got an interesting cover or whatever it is. They may have heard the expression Ethics of Our Fathers and say, oh, Ethics of Our Fighters, maybe there's something there. It's like some kind of something like that. What do you want the takeaway of your book to be, Shlomo?
I want them to understand that there's a sophisticated moral framework to thinking about these issues, that Judaism provides these tools that can inform ourselves, that can inform the world about us, think about this, and that we should believe in this idea that war can be just, that war can be moral, and use that as a barometer for ourselves to judge our behavior. And it's my hope and prayer that, given the fact that it looks like we're going to be fighting for not a short amount of time, whether it's in Gaza or other places, that the book will help build up our moral fortitude. It will build up the tools that we need to have in order to understand when it's moral to fight war and when it's moral to fight how to fight war. And if the book can contribute to that in any different way, whether it's a bestseller or not, I would consider that to be a great contribution.
Okay, that's wonderful. That's going to wrap it up for us. Again, our guest today was Rabbi Dr. Shlomo Brody, wrote a book, Ethics of Our Fighters, A Jewish View on War and Morality, published by Magid Press, and available wherever you get your Jewish books from, and Amazon and all those other places online. I want to thank you so much, Shlomo, for coming on and enlightening us, and we wish you continued success.
Want
Why go to a hospital to get healthy? At Encompass Healthcare, you get the state-of-the-art wound care like in a hospital. The same medicines, the same everything without being in a hospital. Why put yourself at risk of getting a hospital-borne infection? Did you know that last year, 1 in 6 people died in America because of infections they got in hospitals? Encompass Healthcare is an outpatient facility. That means you get your wound care treatment and then go home. There are no wait times at Encompass Healthcare like in ERs. Healthcare is personal and works better, faster, and easier. Encompass Healthcare provides a state-of-the-art outpatient facility close to where you live. Call 248-624-9800. That's 624-9800. Auto accident, workman's comp, and most insurance is accepted. Encompass Healthcare's goal is to get you healthy with as little disturbance to your daily activities. Call 248-624-9800.
Hey, Herschel Fidman here. You are listening to The Jewish Hour. For your listening pleasure, up next, this is Ari Goldwag. Just did a song just about a week ago. It's called Ashira Lashem. Let's sing a song to God.
It can seem so hard to see the brighter side of things, but when I look, I find you, master of everything. The sunshine, the thunder, it all makes me wonder what tomorrow's gonna bring. So I sing to you.
Yeah, I can spend forever singing for your name, 'cause everything gets better the more I grow and change. The sunshine, the thunder, it all makes me wonder if I appreciate. So I sing to you.
Ashir el Hashem chayai, Lashem ki gemal alai. Ashir el Hashem chayai, Lashem ki gemal alai. I thank you all of my life. Ashir el Hashem chayai, my heart is alive inside. Lashem ki gemal alai.
Ashir el Hashem chayai, Lashem ki gemal alai. Ashir el Hashem chayai. Lashem ki gamal alai. I thank you all of my life. Bashir Lashem chayav. My heart is alive inside. Lashem ki gamal alai. Ba-da-ba-dum, ba-dum, 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 ba-dum. Everything's changing, moving at a lightning speed. I gotta keep on gaining, move up and take the lead. Wake up from my slumber, climb out from under to where I wanna be. So I can sing to you,
so I can sing to you,
so I can sing to you.
It's not something so easy,
it's not so
to look at just where I've been.
To look at where I've been.
But if I'm all too busy, I gotta start thinking. Wake up from my slumber, came out from under the darkness that I'm in.
Darkness that
so I can sing to you.
So I can sing to you. Ashir Hashem chayai, Hashem ki gamal alai. Ashir Hashem chayai, Hashem ki gamal alai. Thank you all of my life. Ashir Hashem chayai, my heart is alive inside. Hashem ki gamal alai.
Ashir el Hashem chayai, Hashem ki gamal alai. Ashir el Hashem chayai, Hashem ki gamal alai. I thank you all of my life. Ashir el Hashem chayai, my heart is alive inside.
Hashem ki gamal alai.
We all know there's an opiate epidemic, but Advanced Rapid Detox has a solution for people addicted to pain pills, heroin, and dependent on Suboxone and Methadone. Advanced Rapid Detox performs detox under sedation in the hospital. Patients sleep through withdrawals and wake up without cravings. Dr. Julia Aronoff and the staff at Advanced Rapid Detox help people restore their lives and the lives of their families. Addiction affects everyone, even in the Jewish community. And Advanced Rapid Detox is there to help. Call 800-603-1813. That's 800-603-1813. Or visit them online at www.advancedrapiddetox.com. Herschel Fundman, here you are listening to the Jewish Hour. Up next, for your listening pleasure, this is an oldie, and I may play this every year. I think there's some years I might skip it, but it's become an a cappella classic. This is a Shira choir, and the song is Im Hashem Lo Yivne Bayis. If God hadn't built the temple, well, what would have been?
Hashem lo yivne bayis, shavom leivoy naboyim, Hashem lo yishmorihir, shav shokat shoymai. Im Hashem lo yivne bayis, shavom leivoy naboyim, Hashem lo yishmorihir, shav shokat shoymai. Im Hashem lo yivne bayis, shavom leivoy naboyim, Hashem lo yishmorihir, shav shokat shoymai. Im Hashem lo yivne bayis, shalom lo boi na boi, Im Hashem lo yishmori yid, shav shokat shoymei. Hine, hine, lo yonum ve lo yishon, lo yonum ve lo yishon, shoymei Yisroel. Hine, hine, lo yonum ve lo yishon, lo yonum ve lo yishon, shoymei Yisroel. Hine, hine, lo yonum, lo yonum ve lo yishon, lo yonum ve lo yishon, shoymer Yisroel. Hine, hine, lo yonum, lo yonum ve lo yishon, lo yonum ve lo yishon, shoymer Yisroel. Hashem lo yivne bayis, shalom lo boyna boyim, Hashem lo yishmoy biyim, shav shokat shoymer. Im Hashem lo yivne bayis, shalom lo boi na boi, Im Hashem lo yishmoriyim, shav shokat shoymei. Im Hashem lo yivne bayis, shalom lo boi na boi, Im Hashem lo yishmoriyim, shav shokat shoymei. Im Hashem lo yivne bayis, shalom lo boi na boi, Im Hashem lo yishmoriyim, shav shokat shoymei. Hine, hine, lo yadu, lo yadu ve lo yisham, lo yadum ve lo yisham, shoymei Yisroel. Hine, hine, lo yadum, lo yadum ve lo yisham, lo yadum ve lo yisham, shoymei Yisroel.
And that was the Shir Choir and Im Hashem Lo Yivne Bayis. Up next, this is the Maccabees. This is another one of the Am Yisrael Chai songs. It's called We Are Here.
Tapestry of ages, history unfolds. One people, the unlikeliest of stories ever told. Tiniest of nations, casting light into the dark. Risen, empires they fall, they wield their might against us, but we move on through it all. A lighthouse in the storm, a candle in the night. Through the ages, through the years,
we're still here.
Through the pain and through the tears,
we're still here.
We'll persevere, we'll carry on.
We're still here.
I'm Yisrael, I'm Daikon.
So tonight
same. On and on it goes, but the fire only grows. Through the ages, through the years, through the pain and through the tears, we'll persevere, we'll carry on. I'm Israel, I'm dying calm.
So tonight, we scream into the shadows. So tonight, we keep this flame alive. In this fight, we have us and we have hope. Hear us now, we say, I'm Israel.
Assurance of quality and excellence in kosher? Look for the Michigan K on the label. What's it look like? The Lower Peninsula of Michigan with a K. It's the symbol of the Michigan Kosher Supervisors. Go to their website, mikosup.com. That's M-I for Michigan, K-O for kosher, and S-U-P for supervisors, mikosup.com, and find this month's featured products. You'll find Michigan K products wherever fine food is sold, especially at Natural Food Patch on West 9 Mile Road in Ferndale.
Herschel Finman, here you are listening to the Jewish Hour this week. We are reading the portion of Kedoshim in the synagogue. It can be found in the book of Leviticus chapter 19 and following. It is a list. There's no story. There's not going to be stories for quite a while, actually. 6 weeks? Yeah, 6 weeks. 5 weeks. A list. One mitzvah after another. 51 mitzvahs. Count them, folks. 51 different commandments. And they all fit under the guise of Kedoshim Tiyu. You should be holy. And it talks about different ways in which the Jewish people are not admonished, but charged with being holy. What does the word holy mean in this instance? Holy means different. As is indicated by the last verse of the portion, which is chapter 20, verse 23, which says, you have to make yourselves holy, not like the nations of the world. Okay. And we, therefore, what do we learn from that? This is already after you said from the beginning of the verse, the first verse, back 19:1, says, Kedoshim Tiyu, you should be holy because I'm holy. So it's like, wait, are we repeating ourselves? No. It says, no. 19:1, chapter 19, verse 1, is talking about this idea of being dedicated to God. That's chapter 19:1. Chapter 20, 23, end of chapter 20, is talking about our relationship with people. So there's always, in Judaism, there's always this balance, what we do for God, for Hashem, and what we do for people. It's even on the Ten Commandments. You have a half of one tablet is for God, the other tablet is for people. Keep the Sabbath, don't steal. You know how it goes. So we have to maintain our identity. We are different. Now, this comes up. We talked about this. This is a question that I asked Shlomo Brody. It says, aren't we supposed to be different? You know, the line is, you know, it's become a very big thing. It's a talking point with all these demonstrations on campus. Where were these people when Assad was killing 500,000 of his own people? Where were these people when the United States was in Afghanistan killing thousands and thousands of civilians and nobody cared? Okay, where was it with every other war which has ever perpetrated where civilians were getting blown up and destroyed and killed, etc. And it was always referred to as collateral damage. You know, shirk the shoulders. You know, you should see me how we shirk my shoulders on radio. And then they come back and say, no, Jews are different. We can't do that. We can't be like them. We can't be warlock. We have to. We're not, it says right in the end of the portion. We can't emulate the non-Jews. So in this case, what are we talking about? We're talking about our attitude towards people. So, okay. So there is this law that says if it is fashionable that all the non-Jews wear red shoelaces, so Jews are not supposed to wear red shoelaces because we're supposed to be different. Fine. Good. That's already trivial. Okay. My suits are not made specifically for Jews. I get my suits. I go into a clothing store. I say, listen, I'm a 46 long, sometimes a 48 long, sometimes an extra long. Depends on how it's cut. Give me a suit. And then the other thing is I say, I hope it doesn't have wool and linen in it. And sometimes I have to go get it checked by a guy who knows how to check if there's a mixture of wool and linen because it's a different thing. That's not his problem. But the suit looks like a suit. It doesn't look like a Jewish suit. It's a suit. On Shabbos, I wear a rabbinic coat. Good. Okay. Which is made. I don't think anybody but rabbis wear these things, which is fine. Good. But we have this attitude. Yes. Things have to be different among Jews in how we act towards other people. But there's a very big difference between us and non-Jews. Jews don't do the turn the other cheek thing. Sorry, that's not us. It sounds good. But really what our attitude is, before somebody hits you, you have to hit them. There's an attitude. I have a right to exist. I have a right to live, to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness as well. And if you think that because Jews have never won a war before in like the last 2,000 years since we've been slaved by the Romans and shuffled around Europe and North Africa and in the Middle East and have been considered second-class citizens, that's the status quo. That's normal. We have a plant called a wandering Jew because it spreads out and takes over all over the place because Jews were always told, no, you can't live here anymore. You have to go live someplace else. Get out. That's not what it means to be holy. It doesn't mean that to put your tail through between your legs if we had tails. No, people are going to just look and see, do Jews have tails? No, Jews don't have tails. Just so we don't have horns. And to say we have a right to exist. And what Israel is going through is an existential crisis. It is a right. Are there questions that need to be asked? Are there people that need to be accounted for? Yes. And when this is all done, they will need to be accounted for. Yes, true. There were people who punted, and I've been jumping up and down since October 8th when I found out what happened, saying there are people that need to be accounted for this perpetration of a dastardly deed. But you can't blame the victim. And Jews are the victim. Jews have been the victim. And what's happening is unfortunate, but nowhere else do we see such care in dealing with an enemy. Unfortunately, I could talk about this for the next hour, but I mean, fortunately, I could talk about this for the hour, but unfortunately, we don't have an hour. I have to take a break. We have an inspiring Hasidic story. Don't go away. You're listening to the Jewish Hour.
Why go to a hospital to get healthy? At Encompass Healthcare, you get the state-of-the-art wound care like in a hospital. The same medicines, the same everything without being in a hospital. Why put yourself at risk of getting a hospital-borne infection? Did you know that last year, 1 in 6 people died in America because of infections they got in hospitals? Encompass Healthcare is an outpatient facility. That means you get your wound care treatment and then go home. There are no wait times at Encompass Healthcare like in ERs. Healthcare is personal and works better, faster, and easier. Encompass Healthcare provides a state-of-the-art outpatient facility close to where you live. Call 248-624-9800. That's 624-9800. Auto accident, workman's comp, and most insurances accepted. Encompass Healthcare's goal is to get you healthy with as little disturbance to your daily activities. Call 248-624-9800.
Herschel Finman here. You are listening to The Jewish Hour. Want to get in touch with me? RabbiFinman.com. RabbiFinman. So people ask me, do you have two N's in your name? I say, yes, I do. At different places in the word. Finman. Yes, it's not F-I-N-N, F-I-N-M-A-N. And you'll find a way to contact me because we like to make life easier right on the contact page. I went to a homepage today, and I had to go, without exaggeration, this is to try and locate a guest for the show. This is a nonprofit organization. The donation page was okay, fine. That was like big button right on the homepage, yes. But to get in touch with anybody, it was... four pages. Nope. First page. Right on the homepage. Contact me because what's important to me, people are important. That's the main thing. The donations. Okay, I talk about that last because what else is on RabbiFinman.com? Archived editions of the show, other ways in which we present Judaism, and of course, donations. We are not yet paid up to March. So it's March, April, May we have to do. So we have to do 3 months. I'd like to get the 3 months paid off this week, so that way I don't have to do this business about asking for money and telling you, listen, you need your money to pay, because we've been doing this now for 29 years, and we've worked, but 3 months is about as much as Salem Communications will let us go without actually paying money, because this does cost. The radio and podcasts and stuff, they are not free. We do have some sponsors, but the majority has always been from listeners like you. You've been listening now for 51 minutes. You've liked it. You're going to hear a dynamic story in a couple of seconds. And I'd tell a longer story if I didn't have to do this. So go to RabbiFinman.com, click on the donations page, make it a one-time donation, make it a monthly donation, make it a big donation, make it several smaller donations, however you like to do it. We've got set a series of platforms of numbers you could do. You can pick any of those numbers. You could pick your number. There's an infinite number of numbers that you could pick, any one of them, just as long as they're positive integers. That's the only disclaimer. And do it today. Let's get March at least out of the way. The story. This story I heard recently involves a Mr. Yonason and Dvorah Adler, who live in suburban Washington. They are alive today. Mr. Adler, who was not named Yonason at that time, it doesn't say what his name was at the time, it was probably Jonathan, was in grad school. I think he was learning statistics or accounting or something to do with math. And he met this woman named Debbie, and who is now Dvorah. And after knowing her for about a couple of months, decided he was going to propose to her. And she brought him home, and her mother said, no, he's a long-haired hippie. This is 1968. You're not marrying a long-haired hippie. So he did what he could to accommodate. He got himself. He cut his hair. Don't know if I would cut my hair for my mother-in-law. Made himself look presentable, got himself a nice job with the Social Security Administration as a systems analyst, which systems back then were like, they took up whole rooms. And the two of them actually together worked for it. And slowly by 1969, they had decided to become religious. And what that meant was, is they were not eating in her mother's house. She actually lived about 3 miles away from her mother, in suburban Washington, and this caused great strife. She would go to the house for parties. The mother was big on entertaining and families and having like all the cousins over, you know. So, and you know, Aunt so and so, whatever her mother's name was always the one who had all the family over, the mishpacha. And Johnny and Debbie didn't eat anything. And this, the mother of this made her like, these crazy people, this caused friction like no end, fighting like you wouldn't believe. And this went on for quite a while. And they're to the point where they were thinking, maybe we shouldn't like have anything to do with our parents anymore. It's just like terrible. They were friends with the rabbi in Silver Springs. His name at that point was Itchy Springer. I knew him later as one of the rabbis in the yeshiva, but when he was a young man, he was on campus, which really amazes me because he didn't speak English. But he was quite successful on campus. And he told them, I think this is 1969, you should go visit the Lubavitcher Rebbe. They went for a private audience with the Rebbe. And the Rebbe, as they said, it was very courteous, very polite. And the Rebbe read through their letter and answered them. And he said, his whole series of questions, and he said, when he came up, he says, about your mother-in-law, this is what you should do. You should go more often to your mother-in-law's, but you should not eat anything, not a banana, not an apple, nothing. And you'll see in 3 weeks, it'll be terrible. But after 3 weeks, your mother will see that you want to have a relationship. She'll get the big picture. It'll click. And then he says, the Rebbe thought for a second and said, you know, the problem with the Belt area, with Washington, you have all these interns that come in. They're 24 years old. They call them 24. So 24-year-olds. They work 24 hours a day, and they get $24,000 a year. I don't know how much they get now, but that was like what they were called like not that long ago, 24s. It's how people started their careers, coming out of college, you know, as they're working on their master's. And she says, they don't have anybody to teach them. They have nobody. She says, specifically in the laws of what's referred to as Taras HaMishpacha, Jewish family purity, the laws of going to mikveh, how a husband and wife should ask. You, when you go back to Washington, you should let people know that you're prepared to teach the laws of family purity. And they're thinking, we've only been religious for about a year and a half. What do we know? This is, they were keeping it. She was going to mikveh. They knew the laws. But the Rebbe's line was always, if you know Aleph, don't wait till you know Base. You don't have to know the whole alphabet. If you know the first letter, it's good enough. Teach the first letter. So they went back, and it led to be in no time. They were known as the mikveh teachers of the Beltway. And people were coming to them. And in the course of this is from 1970, the last 50 years, it says they've taught thousands of couples and introduced thousands of families to the laws of family purity. And, oh, by the way, what happened with their mother-in-law? So they started going. She said they used to go every Shabbos to her mother's house. They started going a couple times a week. And they didn't eat anything, which infuriated the mother. It's like a Jewish mother. The worst thing is I can't feed you. What am I, some kind of leper? But after 3 weeks, as the Rebbe predicted, the mother said, you know what? I just want you to come. I want you to be here. Bring paper plates. Bring your own food. Just come. She didn't say, I'll kosher the kitchen. That far she didn't go. But the relationship was smoothed over. That's going to do it. We hope we had a chance to entertain you a bit. We hope we had a chance to educate you a bit. We hope you have a great week. We hope to see you back again next week. Take care. עמד עלינו לחלותינו עמד עלינו לחלותינו